is one of the most thoughtful and penetrating thinkers in general about halachic issues in particular, and the intersection of halacha and ethical issues. You know, over the last few weeks, I've had many conversations with different people on some of the ethical issues that we have to think about during this war. So when Rabbi Klapper was coming, we decided that he would speak about the halachic and ethical issues around civilian casualties in war. For those of you who are in my halacha class, you know, the second half of the year when we moved to tshuva writing, that was something I got from Rabbi Klapper, which his summer program, that's what we do, is we learn a halachic topic for 6 weeks, and then he posts a theoretical halachic shaila, and then we all have to answer it. So I got that exercise from my clapper, and I'm bringing it here. But if you want to try it with the original, then I do encourage you to think about joining Rabbi Klapper, because, yeah, having done it 4 years myself, I do endorse it, but that's the end of my advertising. And Rabbi Klapper, it's all yours.
Okay. Yeah. Terrific. Will you send around a sign-up sheet? People sure. Want to get my divrei Torah, that'd be terrific. It is worth coming to Israel just to be introduced by Rabbi Zering. It was really like one of the enduring chesed of my life that he let me stand in front of the classroom for those 4 summers. And I get to do it once again. It's really cool. And you can all overhear while we're talking. Okay, I want to start by reading a quote that's really central to my thinking about war and ethics, and has been for at least 20 years. And like many of the statements of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, it's one that I wrestle with. And I can present it to you, because I think it's critically important, but critically important doesn't mean that you have to take it exactly as is. It means you have to think about it really deeply, and if you haven't engaged with it, you're not dealing with the topic with the topic well. Here's the quote, and he says, "Ulam." Right, this is in a discussion of military ethics. He says, "Ulam chashuv biyoter shehadam hayotzei lemilchama yodea she'enhu over meolam baal sulam arakim echad leolam baal sulam arakim shone." It's critically important. It's vital that a person going out to war understand that they have not left a world with one sulam arakim, I see that variously translated as ladder or scale or set of values, to a world with different values. So that statement is deliberately intended to oppose a thesis that war creates an environment in which there is only one value, and that only value is victory. That position has been articulated in halachic contexts, and the first article I wrote about this was in opposition to Rabbi Michael Broyd, who took that position, that in war, the only value is victory. So Rabbi Lichtenstein argues that's not the case. The problem is that as people of halacha, we don't generally see ourselves as living in a world of pure values. We live in a world of law. Right, that's what halacha is. And war is not an environment that halacha has chosen to populate with detailed law. So in practice, how does it play out? How does it play out to live in the same world of values in the context of war as you live in everywhere else? And secondly, is it true? Because victory is not really a goal in civilian society. There are not so many things that we say you can do so that you will win and another person will lose. We don't like zero-sum games. Right? Not so much in other areas, right, is would we allow you to say you can do different things to succeed. So is war different? Right? So maybe war isn't exactly the same, because maybe victory is a value in war in a way it's not in other places. Okay, but I want to, you know, to me, like the first challenge that Rav Lichtenstein says this, and that that cuts right to the heart of it, that the notion that war is a place without values, or where the values that govern life from a Jewish perspective everywhere else just disappear, that has to be wrong. Okay, what values are we talking about? So I gave you a set of psukim, mishnayos, gemaras, that I think can be framed as articulating values, although in context, some of them are articulating halachot, and you have to make, it's a move to say that this halachic position is actually articulating a value, so that even in a context where the halacha won't apply technically, it still has something to say to us about how we live it, right? So the first thing, which is, I think, central to everything, is the Psukim in Bereishit Perek Tet in Parshas Noach, where it says, V'achetimchem l'nashra seichem edrosh miyad kol chaya edroshanu u'miyad ha'adam miyad ish achiv edrosh et nefesh ha'adam shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam demo yishofech ki b'tzelem Elohim asah et ha'adam. Right, so there is, there are three roles that human beings play in this pasuk. There's the victim, there's the perpetrator, and there's the judge. Now, the claim I want to make is that each of these are affected by the status of a human being as Tzelem Elohim. Right, that the enormity of the crime is because it was killed by Tzelem Elohim, because you think what was killed was Tzelem Elohim. The enormity of the crime is that it was killed by Tzelem Elohim, right? Because only Tzelem Elohim can be held accountable for doing something wrong. One should recognize that when you call human beings who commit terrible acts animals, you're actually denying their responsibility. You're not holding them accountable. Right? So the second thing is that, right, so the second aspect is that it matters a great deal that the perpetrator was at Tzelem Elohim. The third thing is that part of being at Tzelem Elohim, if you read the opening, right, you all know this, but you read the opening of the Mishnah of the Marne Huch, it makes it explicitly clear, is that human beings are judges. Right? They have they have a responsibility to bring people to account. Right? So that's the first thing, right? The central idea. Yes. What's your name? You're Baruch's son? Is your father Baruch?
Oh, no, he's not.
He's your uncle. I see. Okay.
By calling them an animal, couldn't that be you saying that they're rejecting their celibacy? They can reject their celibacy.
So I think, right, what's really a privileged status, right? So that's, you being human is not one of the privileged statuses of being human, is that you're accountable for your actions,
right?
So I don't think you gain anything, and I think you, right, I think you lose a lot when you, right, when you refer to human beings as animals because of their actions. That's what I want, right? That's why I'm making that claim, right? That the pasuk, right, everything about the pasuk is tied up into ki b'tzelem Elohim asah et ha'adam. Okay, right, so there's three aspects of humanity. Now, how does that play out? So the Mishnah Sanhedrin tells you that there's a law called Rodef that allows you to intervene to kill person A who is attempting to kill person B. All right, so that, right, that's an aspect of accountability and, right, and of justice because of the, right, because of the humanity of the victim. But you have to play it out, right? What if the Rodef is not guilty? Right, so if you think this is a question of justice, so then you can't use Rodef in cases where the Rodifa is an accident as opposed to a question of deliberate choice, and, right, it gets very complicated. There's an extension of that to the law of Baba Machteret. The law of the Machteret, the furtive thief, lets you even engage in preemptive Rodef act, although there's a question about whether that Rodef is probably a mitzvah. In the Rambam, Baba Machteret is probably a permission and not a mitzvah. And that can also, right, that interesting why it would play out that way. Gemara says Rava says the reason Baba Machteret is that there seems to be an imperative of Bala Hargacha Hashkem Largo, and there's a Yalka Chimoni that seems to extend that to the national level. That learns from Milchemet Midian, Bala Hargacha Hashkem Largo applies to nations as well, and that's a really deep question. One of the, but Lichtenstein says you haven't left the world of, you haven't left the world of with one set of values to another. So are you living in the same set of values if you say that the value that individuals do not have ultimate value in the context of war? Is that really the right? Do we say it's the same set of values, just normally in normal context that set of values applies to individuals, and here, right, the set of values applies only to the group? Or we say no, that would be a violation of Lichtenstein's principle if we suddenly lost track of the significance of individual human beings. Because you know what? Nations are not created by Tzelem Elohim. Right? Human beings are. So that's like a fundamental challenge in Lichtenstein's principle about whether war changes the calculus of the value, right, from the value of individuals to the right to the value of groups. Okay. Then you have you have the story of the two people in the desert, which ends up with Rabbi Akiva saying "V'chei achicha imach, chayecha kodim l'chaye achicha," and this applies even though the other person is not a rodeh. Right, so you're allowed to, under some circumstances, to prefer your life to somebody else's, and I have to figure out under what circumstances are you, if you're allowed to prefer your life to somebody else's, so why would you need a special pasuk to teach you that you can kill a rodeh? On the other hand, a third party can kill a rodeh, but a third party cannot choose to give the canteen of water to one person over another because they prefer them. All right, so that's worth thinking about as well. Then we have the Gemara Sanhedrin, famously, which says there are three things you have to give your life up, and this to me is klal gadol b'Torah. The Gemara asks, how do we know the three things you have to give your life up for? Avodah Zarah, there's a pasuk. Gilei Arayot, there's a pasuk, but the pasuk of Gilei Arayot is not a pasuk which says that you have to give up your life rather than commit Gilei Arayot. The pasuk just says Gilei Arayot is just like murder. So in order to understand the pasuk which teaches you that Gilei Arayot is Yareg Vel Yavor, you have to already know that about murder. And how do we know that about murder? So the Gemara says we know that about murder because of the Svara. There's no pasuk. And the Svara, the Gemara does not articulate as a principle, but articulates in a story. Somebody comes to Rabba or Rava, depending what gears you have, and says, "Right, I was told by the master of my manor, whatever it may be, kill that person, or I'll kill you. Am I allowed to? Right, implicitly, am I allowed to kill that person in order to stop him from killing me?" And the answer that he gives is, "No, let him kill you, and let you not kill, because my chazis or miyemar, depending which text you have." Who says your life is redder than his? Your blood is redder than his. Now that's an amazing moment because we already learned a pasuk, which said which says you are allowed to prefer your life to somebody else's. And despite the fact that we have a pasuk which we paskin like Rabbi Akiva who interprets as saying means the Gemara says that a fundamental moral principle without which you can't get Torah right. Because we don't just learn this halacha from Svara. There's a pasuk in the Torah which assumes they already learned this halacha from Svara, which says, "Who says your blood is redder than his?" Okay, now who says your blood is redder than his has to have some right. If that's a central value, as I'm articulating, right, it's a value in many ways prior to halacha, because you can't understand the halachic pasukim of the Torah without this value. So if we're going to live in war. In wartime, and with the same set of values, this has to be expressed as well. But what would it mean in wartime to say that you can't decide whose blood is redder? Okay, so that's the beginning of trying to set out what it would mean to try to translate the sulam arakim of civilian life into military life. Okay, so let's now try and engage in the endeavor. Of trying to apply it to life, but you can ask, you know, every time we go through a case halacha, you can ask the question: Is this playing out the values in the same right in the, and even the sulam arakim, even the scale of values that plays out in civilian life? Okay, so we'll start with what I think 20, 30 years ago, if you had a conversation about the civilian casualties in halacha in America, you'd probably start with this article from my teacher, by J. David Bleich. And it's certainly, when I was first thinking about these issues many, many years ago, this was something that I engaged with very differently than I engaged with Rav Lichtenstein's article. Rabbi Bleich has an article on the permissibility of a nuclear war in halacha. So Baruch Hashem, you grew up in the post-collapse of the Berlin War era. And the live prospect of a nuclear war, which will devastate the world, is not really something that probably that keeps you up at night. You have more immediate things, obviously, this year in Israel. But just like, you know, we in a world which isn't balanced between two superpowers, each of which has the capacity to blow the entire world up multiple times, this is not a major prospect. But you should be aware that if you were coming of age somewhere between 1945 and 1990, it was hard to go through a day without thinking about the possibility the world will blow up tomorrow. And of course, if you're from, the question then is it Mutter to blow up the world? We wouldn't want it to happen if it were us, right? Okay, so Reb Black wrote the following, which I'm sure you'll all find very reassuring now. He says, the Gemara Shua 35b declares, a sovereign power which slays 1/6 of the population of the universe. It's an interesting formulation of the universe. He doesn't say human population, so you can all ask the questions about aliens, right, whether they count or not, which I'm sure is immediately coming to mind. If you haven't already, you should all read Rabbi Lam's article about the possibility of extraterrestrial life in Halakha, which is just an amazing thing that somebody, Rabbi Lam, Ruyan Dorin Lemish Amram, wrote in an intelligent article about the possibility of extraterrestrial life in Halakha. And you can work all, you can work all, no one, I think just about no one has had the chutzpah to do anything but quote him since.
No, Rabbi Price.
Right, you showed me, right? Yeah. Same price, yeah, same time. Okay. Thank you, right? I forgot that you showed me that.
Which is even more wild.
Okay, we can look up all of these things. But slaying more than 1/6 of the population of the universe does engender culpability. However, right, Tosfos, understanding the dictum is referring to the monarch of a Jewish state, indicates that the Gemara here imposes a constraint on a milchemet reshut, or discretionary war. The sovereign may not initiate discretionary war if it is to be anticipated that an inordinate number of people, that means more than 1/6 of the world population, which is something like a billion now, I forget, the world population is somewhere in 7 billion now?
Eight.
Okay, so right, so one should be very careful, should you be in a decision-making position, not to initiate a milchemet reshut, which has a likelihood of killing more than 1.35 billion people. But 1.34, we're good. Well, now 8 billion, 1.33. 1.33 is perfectly okay, l'halacha. Now, how you translate this into civilian life? It doesn't seem like we're living in the same set of values as civilian life if 1.33 billion casualties is fine. Okay. According to Tosfos analysis, however, this does not apply to Milchemet Mitzvah. That was really, that's the one that kept me up at night. Right, that for Milchemet Mitzvah, 1.33 billion is not a ceiling anymore. Okay, that's really, this was a thing which really kept me up. There is a cheerful thing, though, that Rabbi Blech notes is a Shuvah Sam Sofer, who has a much lower threshold. Sam Sofer actually, and this is important, Sam Sofer actually imposes a prohibition against genocide and defines it, not exactly the same way the UN does. Genocide is the killing of 1/6 of any, let's say, ethnically identifiable population. So it's not 1.33 billion overall. It's that, you're right, let's say the population of, let's say, the Falkland Islands is, 4,000. So you can launch a war that overall kills 1.33 billion people, so long as it doesn't kill more than 670 people in the Falklands. But if you go to 672 in the Falklands, then that's us. Okay, it's really, I'm doing it in a way which is a little bit extreme, but you should be aware that the notion that there's a prohibition against genocide is a really big chiddush. And I play this out in halacha in the question of whether there's an obligation to intervene, that may be the category of rodef on a national level, just like the category of rodef for individuals applies if an individual is at risk. So the category of rodef on a national level applies if some kind of identifiable group is at risk, and there's an obligation, and just as there's a mitzvah to intervene to stop X from killing Y individually, so there's a mitzvah for a nation to intervene to stop nation X from killing nation Y individually. So halachic definition of genocide might actually be important, and I raised this at the point when the Yazidis were being surrounded by ISIS, and it was a question about how much of an obligation there was on the part of the U.S. to intervene. And it might be that there's an obligation to intervene against genocide, halacha, in international law. Okay, right, just a way of thinking about how halacha and values can play out in real life. Okay, so that's Bleich's position, which the Chazon Ish says that Rabbi Bleich is obviously an extreme liberal. He doesn't really understand how Rabbi Bleich reaches this conclusion. Chazon Ish was before Rabbi Bleich, but others says the following: V'yesh la'yein. So why should, right, if in fact all 8 billion all 8 billion non-Jews in the world are not keeping the Shavuot Mitzvot, says the Chazon Ish. Why shouldn't you be able to enforce the Shavuot Mitzvot, even if that wipes out more than a sixth? Okay. So in case you weren't, you know, in case what you weren't saying up at night already, that's really a tough question. The Chassam Sofer brings us back to a universe that is more in tune with where I am morally. So the Chassam Sofer says that it brings the question home, right? And this is really a central question that we have to think about all through the question of halachic and Jewish military ethics. And I'm going to go back to a question, and I'll ask, you know, maybe a very dangerous question, and I probably won't ask for a show of hands because that'll force you to commit, but I want all of you to be thinking about this as a central question. The Svara, right, which I'm arguing is at the center of Jewish civilian ethics, and therefore, according to Lichtenstein, has to be at the center of Jewish military ethics, is who says your blood is redder than his? Okay? Does that, that's a Svara. It has no pasuk, so it's something that has to arise from your own spiritual intuition and or your reading of non-halachic sections of Torah, such as the pasuk, Shofech dam adam badam damay shofech ki b'tzelem Elohim asah et adam. Does that svara apply when one party is Jewish and the other is not? Right. Because if that svara applies to Jews and non-Jews, so then war between Jews and non-Jews plays out and in a way where everything has to be reversible. Everything, right? The test, right? One test of whether this is okay for Jews to do this when fighting a war which isn't a civil war is if the other side did it to us under the same circumstances, would that be okay with us military, halachically and ethically? If you don't start off with that premise, then you can just say, well, you know, the ethics of war don't have to create level playing fields. They're, right? It's just legal for us and us are for them. Right? So that right, the question, right, so the question we should have asked, we said 1/6 of the world population. Well, guess what? There aren't so many Jews. You can kill all the Jews in the world and still have 132 billion left over. Plus 900 million, right, et cetera. So maybe it's perfectly mutter to start a war that that ends in the genocide of the Jews, not the targeted genocide of the Jews, that would be, right, but the accidental genocide of the Jews. Is that okay? I think not. But if you just took Rabbi Bleich's reading in the Chazon Ish, that is a plausible outcome, which is why the Chassam Sofer comes along, and the Chassam Sofer says, hang on a sec. If that's the case, why does God get angry at Nebuchadnezzar when Nebuchadnezzar's actions seem likely to cause genocide among the Jews? Right? Nebuchadnezzar, the Chassam Sofer claims, puts it in beautifully traditional terms. You can take a look at the last paragraph on page 2. He says, Yesh Lefarish. The cave of the Malchut diktala chad mishita enon enash, since the kingdom which wipes out 1/6 of the world's population is not punished. In Cain, Nebuchadnezzar, v'chayotze bo'amolech b'kipa, so Nebuchadnezzar and any others who rule over the globe, right, under rule over the section, the earth under the dome, right, if you want. V'yisrael achad mishivim umot, and the Jews are at most 1/70th of his empire, because if you rule the world, right, in traditional terms, you rule 70 nations. So therefore, so there should be no punishment if Nebuchadnezzar wipes us out. Sonenu here is right, lashon sagi nahor, right? If he wipes out, why should God be angry at them? Because he's allowed to wipe out more than 1/6 of the world. Who says it even has to be in a justified war? This is Muhammad Rashut. He wants to expand his kingdom. The province of Judea is in the way. The way to conquer it is to, right, is genocide. So what's the big deal? So here, the Chassam Sofer says, Ela shezeh eino, she'ein lo reshut la'abed min osug echad shalem, ki'ima shishit mimenu. Right? Because it's not true. You're not allowed to wipe out any population, which, right, more than 1/6 of any distinct population, and therefore you can't commit genocide against the Jews, just like you can't commit genocide against anybody else. Rav Sam Sofer doesn't say Jews are different. He says that the rules of genocide have to be reversible. Okay, that's a really important principle. However, right, none of this, you know, leaves me in a terribly happy condition. I want to read the Gemara with you, and I want to read the Tosis with you, and raise the possibility that maybe all this is wrong, with appropriate humility, and especially to my teacher Rabbi Bleich. This is really the only place where I ever, I think, disagree with him publicly. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, it seems to be though from the next line in the Chadish Sofer that.
Right, they're not counted as just part of the generic group of non-Jews. We have a distinctive element.
Okay, I thought it was that they're not considered their own nation, unlike the Jews. So it's that.
No, he says that the Jews are a distinct nation and not just counted where they are among the non-Jews. Right, that's right. You might think that Jews, because we're scattered in exile, right, we're not a distinct population for the purposes of this principle. No, it applies even to Jews. All right, good question, though. Thank you. Please question me if my readings are not obvious. Okay, so here's the. We're now on page 3. Let's read the. Gemara. The Gemara says, "Kol Shlomo ha'amurin b'shir hashirim kodesh, shir l'misha shalom lo." So in general, right, shir hashirim is understood by this breita as an allegory in which the Melech Shlomo is God. Right? So all right, every Shlomo that's in Shir HaShirim is a reference to the one who possesses peace, meaning God. Chutz mizeh, karmi shali lefanai, elef lecha Shlomo, umatayim lenotrim et piryo. Okay, so that pasuk, the Shlomo is actually the secular kingdom Shlomo. He gets 1,000. And with Tayin and the Trim of Priyo, and 200 go to the rabbis, V'yeshom Avzechol, and the whole question of which one is Chol. It's based on that pasuk, right? The 200 and the 1,000. So 200 is 1/6 of 1,200. That Shmuel says, Malchuta dektal echad mishita ba'alma lo me'ansha shenemar karmi shali lefanai elef lecha Shlomo leMalchuta derekia. Right. So he disagrees with the notion. Sorry, Shmuel disagrees with the notion that Shlomo is Chol, right? He thinks that there's another Shlomo that's Chol, which is the name of Tisha Lefanai. He thinks that Shlomo is Kodesh. So what does it mean that Shlomo gets 1,000 and Matayim Lelotrim et Peryo get 200? The answer is that God gets 1,000, but the human kingdom gets 200, which means human kingdoms get a sixth. Okay, and if you kill more than a sixth, then you are liable. So the question is does that mean, Rabbi Bleich said it means, and the Chazon Ish seems to have assumed it meant, and maybe the Chassam Sofer, but we'll see, we'll talk about the Chassam Sofer in a minute, that means that a king gets to kill a sixth of the world or a sixth of any other nation. So Rashi says the following, Dekat lechad bishita, kilomar b'angaria davodat ha-melech. You can kill up to a sixth in the king's work gangs. And Tosfos says, when taking them out to a optional war. So tell me why this is the exact opposite of what Rabbi Bleich and I believe the Chavz Nish said. Okay, yes, Yoni, you can be a meringer. Exactly right. Exactly right. The Gemara is not talking about the capacity to kill other nations. The Gemara is talking about what sort of effect your policies can have on your internal community. If you launch a major public works project, right, what percentage of the population can you kill? Now we would be kind of upset with a population that killed, right, with a works project that killed 1/6 of the population. And so we have to figure out how we deal with this in Gemara in any case. And Dafka Shlomo, right, and the massive work projects that were involved in building the palaces and the Beit HaMikdash is a good test question to figure out what sorts of burdens the king can impose on his internal population. But Rashi says it has nothing to do with war at all. It's entirely to do with internal labor gangs. And Tosfos says it's talking about Melchemet Rashut, but he's talking about whether you can launch an optional war with casualty expectations on your side of 1-6. Doesn't say anything about the other side, and that's why it only applies to Milchamet Rishut, not on Milchamet Mitzvah, because in Milchamet Mitzvah, maybe you're entitled, right? If you lose, everybody gets wiped out, so why should there be a casualty limits internally? Yes, Ben.
Is it your understanding that clear in Rashi Tosfos that's internal, or just that it's
yes.
not clear whether it's internal?
No, I think it's clear. Angaria, what could Angaria mean?
I just don't know what Angaria means.
Angaria is a draft.
A draft.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading, I can imagine reading Rashi as when you go to war against an outside force, and
where's war? Where did you get war?
Or you're going to take foreigners or take foreign neighbors as workers, which was not unheard of in past societies.
So I think if you look at Angaria, you'll see that's not what Angaria means, and why introduce that, right? That's not the it's the people under your authority, right? Now what you know, whose authority a conquered populace is in, right? That we could talk about, right? But it's not talking about going out to war against people not under your authority. I don't think. Okay, right. So on the one hand, there is a 20th century tradition of believing that that there's that limit on civilian casualties. The limit on civilian casualties is 1.33 billion, and or genocide. And on the other hand, maybe it's just wrong. Yes. Yes. We don't encourage you to do this. Right? You're saying, nobody says kings should kill between 1/5 and 1/6 of their population with labor, otherwise the population gets soft. Right. Nobody suggested there's a mitzvah to cull the world, right? Because they have an overpopulation problem. So everyone's no. All right. Absolutely. Right. This is, you know, I think everyone understands that this is the extreme of the kulam. Even if you pass you that is okay. Yes. Yeah. Even. Lo me'anshe. Yeah. So the language lo me'anshe, you could even extend it that way. You know, the pasuk doesn't seem to say if the pasuk, the base pasuk that we're darshaning is a matayim l'trimit period, doesn't seem so mashma. So I don't, yeah, but I think in terms of war, the application of this verse to war is, so far as I can tell, against Rashi and Tosfot. I don't know at this point of any Rishon who is compatible with the Chazon Ish's reading. And now you go back and look at the Chasam Sofer and think about whether he's talking about war per se, maybe something, you know. And you can say, look, you know, Rabbi Klapper, you're reading this against the Chazon Ish, maybe the Chasam Sofer, and certainly Rabbi Bleich, so you can reject it. But on the other hand, you know, that doesn't seem to be what it's talking about. Okay, the Hamek Davar, rather than Netziv, seems to say something that might be, in a way, more radical. He says, right, Miyad Ish Achiv, we're going back to our fundamental pasuk, Piresha Kadosh Baruch Hu, Ematai Ha'adam Ne'enash, B'sha'asher U'i Linhog Be'achva. Mash Enkein, Bishat milchama ve'et lisno, az et larog, ve'ein onesh al zeklal, kikach nosata olam, and he goes on, ukud isa b'shvut, daflamet hayam abet, so he reads it that way too. Malchusa dekat lomechad b'shita lome anesh, but then he flips it, v'afilu melech Yisrael mutar lasot milchemet harashut, af agav shekama Yisrael yehergu. Right, so the Tziv seems to think that that pasuk is limited by the phrase miyad ish achiv. But if you create a situation where human beings are not brothers, so then you're allowed to kill each other. The prohibition against killing only applies to in the context of brotherhood. And the Tziv is often understood as essentially saying, right, taking the position that Rabbi Breud took and they argue against, which is that war is a, right, that the normal ethics only apply in situations of fraternity. In the absence of a situation of fraternity, there is no such thing. Now we have to figure out, so you know, don't we have a default setting that human beings are in fraternity? Sure. We have a default setting that human beings are fraternity, except when there's a war. And now we have a tactical question, which is, what counts as a war? And that's an important question in international law also. And you probably know in American history, let's say, for example, the Korean War. Anybody know, was the Korean War a war? No. No, Korean War wasn't a war, right? What was it? Police action. Because only Congress can declare war. And then Vietnam, that was not a war either. Right? And so America spent a long time not going to war, but sending its armies and killing lots of people and having lots of soldiers killed because it couldn't legally be a war. So we also figure out halachically, what's a war? Milchemet Rishut, right, well, as we'll see, right, requires the Rishus of the Sanhedrin, apparently. So maybe without Sanhedrin, we can't write, unless it's a Melchemet Mitzvah, there can't be a war. That causes all sorts of conniptions among early Zionist figures who are not sure they can make every military action of the State of Israel a Melchemet Mitzvah. But on the other hand, if it's a Melchemet Rishut, it becomes Usur. So that creates all sorts of conniptions and all sorts of theories that are developed. Okay, but Netziv seems to think that war is a war is an unethical zone. At least the fundamental value we're talking about of Shofech Dam Adam doesn't apply. And I'll just leave you. Let's see where that goes. So the Gemara Sanhedrin says the following. The Rami Seda in Kiddushin says the following. Talking about the case of David, as you know, right? David sends in order to Pashut Pshat. You can deal with Kolomer David Chata anyway, Latoa later. Right, Pashut Pshat, David sends Uriah Chiti into the front lines of battle and has the army retreat and leaves him to die in order to cover up his liaison with Bathsheba. Tosfot says that, how is that okay? It's not okay, right? That was right, you know, Natan HaNavi tells him, right, tells Atah Ish, right, because it's not okay. But let's assume, right, but Tosfot wants to know, how is it halachically okay? Because Frum Jews don't sin by violating halacha mostly, Frum Jews sin by distorting halacha. Right, so how could David have possibly thought it was okay? And then once the, you know, you come with a good enough argument, maybe it's too good. So Tosfos says that Uriah was Moreid b'malchut because he rejected David's order to go home and sleep with Bathsheba, which would have been just as effective at hiding the liaison. Okay, so now the Meromei Seda says the following. Look at the asterisk. He says, Manira. You can't, it's not fair to say that Uriah was a Morid B'Malchus because he rejected an order which had its fundamentally immoral purpose and which he couldn't have known what the purpose was, perhaps. So how can you call Uriah a Morid B'Malchus? Tosfos came with all sorts of ways which you can make Uriah a Morid B'Malchus. Aval kol ze eno Morid Emet shechayev malav mitzah. But no reasonable person would say that Uriah deserved death as a Morid B'Malchus for these crimes. Right? So this is an important principle to understand in halacha generally, that sometimes we say things are chayiv misa, that doesn't mean every version of the crime there is a mitzvah to kill the person for committing it. It means that there is a version of the crime in which it is permissible to kill somebody for doing it. And it might be that legally we can't tell you in advance which is which, but if you killed somebody for this crime, for the minor version of this crime, that would be an error. And this is important for understanding the claim that all Sheva Mitzvot are Chayiv Mita. Right, so the Sefer says, look, Morid B'Malchus is Chayiv Mita. It doesn't mean that because you can construct a case in which somebody is in technical violation of Morid B'Malchus, that it's okay to kill them. And so the claim that Uriah should die because of this disobedience of David's orders is a fundamental error. Rather, says the Netziv, Ella, right? Let's not kid ourselves, right? If there weren't the issue of Bathsheba, David wouldn't have thought that Uriah was a Morid B'Malchus. So what he's doing isn't really the kind of Morid B'Malchus for which he should be executed. However, Netziv says, Ella achar shebikesh David ladunot k'morid b'malchus, lo ne'enashalo. But because David thought of the idea of trying him for Morid B'Malchus, therefore David can't be punished as a murderer. Shezeh Reshut HaMelech, because guess what? We have a thing called martial law. And under martial law, people are just, kings, governments are fundamentally unaccountable for their actions. So long as they have the form of law, you can't second guess judgments. Right, so war is where war, says the Netziv, is a fundamentally different legal zone, not a fundamentally different ethical zone. It was wrong of David to kill Uriah, but it's a fundamentally different legal zone in which, just as the king has the permission to cause casualties among the enemy, so too he has permission to cause casualties among his own people, and those powers are indistinguishable. There's no accountability either way. Okay, so if that's the world you want to live in, in which there is no accountability for the government towards your side, then you can live in a world in which your government has no accountability towards the other side. Right, so you can decide if that is the if that's the halakhic universe you want to live in. Okay, so that's the end of parts 1 and 2. Okay, we have a claim of what value that the Bear of Lichtenstein's claim countered by various positions which I attribute to one person, but there are other people to whom it's attributed. We have a set of values as to what it would be, which might be what Lichtenstein is talking about. We have a claim that those values don't really apply in the context of war, as evidenced by a principle about civilian casualties, which I suggest is actually just an error, but apparently a widely shared error among many great people. So you have to figure out how you deal with that. And then you have a nesiv, which really articulates the counterposition, but also articulates the cost of the counterposition. You can't have a world in which all ethics, right, all accountability is suspended regarding the enemy and still have accountability among yourself. And that's a pretty realistic picture, that once you lose accountability towards the enemy, you lose accountability towards yourself as well. Yes?
I have two questions. The first one is, does Ron bring this halakha down?
Which
halakha? About killing one sixth of the people?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, okay. So what if someone just says, you know, the Rambam doesn't bring it down, this is...
No, interesting argument. You could try that too.
Not halacha.
Okay, you want to try that argument? That's fine with me. I don't, you know, that's, it's hard to talk about what Pesach is, and I guess it's, I think the problem that, you know, making my son-in-law likes to say that because the Rambam wrote the only Hilchot Malachim, we give the Rambam excessive weight in areas of that, and so that probably we want to counter the excessive weight of the Rambam rather than say he didn't quote it, therefore it's not halacha.
But the fact he doesn't quote this in halacha would imply that he would disagree with those that say it is halakha. Meaning, he doesn't think.
Could be he has no halakhos of internal, like, could be he read the Gemara the way I did, and it's just not part of the things he's dealing with halakhically.
Yeah.
So if you want, I'd rather you brought a raya for me.
Well, and just he say doesn't it. Believe that this is a principle.
Or it doesn't fit into any section of Mishnah Torah, which it would in the context of war, but he doesn't have so much in the Mishnah Torah about the internal administration responsibilities of the king.
Maybe if it's a halakha, he would put it down in the Mishnah Torah.
You think he quotes everything in Gemara the halacha?
Well, anything that, he thinks is halacha would he not.
That's an interesting claim. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think, doesn't he say there's only book you need? There's a Torah,
okay, so that's a great question. You know, that's a great, but it's far afield. He does say that. And so if you take that literally and you think that he sees it as his job to comprehensively include everything in Torah Shebal Peh, that's the halacha, then that's a great question. I'm not sure that we should take it quite so literally. Particularly in the areas that aren't la'alacha l'ma'aseh, right? You know, so did he mean that even when Mashiach comes, this is the only book you'll need? Hard to believe, because we're going to have he understood that we'd have a much, much more detailed Hilchot Malachim, right? When we had a government, I think. But I want to honor the question. I don't share the premise that we should take that with absolute literalness.
And the second question is that,
yeah,
regarding Milchamas Rishus,
yeah,
the Rambam does say that you offer peace to them, and if they don't accept peace, and they don't accept the Shemesh Ben Yinoach, you kill all the males. So clearly there is a distinction between when there's Achva, when, you know, there's Shalom, and when there's not. Like, clearly, you just, like, you know...
Yeah, that you can't kill people when it's not war.
But once you're in war, right, there seems to be different boundaries.
And there's different boundaries from Milchamas Rishus and Milchamas Mitzvah. In Achinami. And we'll... You could take that as saying that there are no boundaries, as, you know, that you're in war, you can kill whoever you want. That's exactly what I want to do next, is show you how Poskim read that. And you could tell me, but I'm being hypocritical, because when I came to the Gemara, I'm caring about Amish Pshat of the Gemara, even though the Akronim read it this way. And here I'm now going to make a reverse argument. I'm going to take a text and care more about its reception history than about the way it was read originally. And that's a fair critique. All right, but let me try and show you how I'm doing it, okay? Thank you. What's your name?
Moshe
Rosenthal. Excellent. Okay, so now we're on the top of page 5, I believe. We're on page 4. Okay, so this, we're going to read a Maharal. Maharal says, Guri Ari is Maharal's parish on Rashi. Maharal says the following. Ach kasha, right? Im shchem chata, kola ira mechat ul harob. Right, so it's a question you all recognize, right? What justifies Shimon and Levi legally? Again, you know, be careful. The question of what justifies them legally is not the same question as whether they are justified ethically, right? But what justifies Shimon and Levi legally in killing the entire population of Shechem because they had made, you know, because they had raped Dina and were holding her hostage. Okay, v'tiris haramam d'dei Noach mitzvah al hadinin. And so the Rambam gives a famous answer. You all know the machlokas Rambam and Ramban, where the Rambam says that they that the population, the entire population, was in violation of the isur of dinim, and the Ramban says that dinim is mitzvah aseh. You're not chayiv misa for it, even right. Then we could talk right, bearing in mind the question we talked earlier about what chayiv misa means for mitzvah bei Noach. But the Gurari starts off by saying what. He thinks the Rambam, what the Rambam says is astonishing. How could the other Shechemites have been expected to reasonably hold the leaders of their political community accountable? Right? They are reasonably afraid of the leaders of their people, not least because they've already shown what kind of people they are. Right, people who would rape random passersby are very likely to react poorly to political dissidents. Even though Bnei Noach are obligated in regard to dinim, haynu kishuchlu ladun, aval ones rachman apatre ve'ech efshar lahem ladunotam. Right, so we should say around the whole question of what things are yehurag vel yavor, what things are not yehurag vel yavor. But who says dinim? Even if you hold that there is a concept of Yehurag Vel Yavor for non-Jews, who says it applies to dinim? So what are Shimon Levi talking about? What is the Rambam talking about? So the Maral says, "V'nir de lo kashamidi, mishum de lo dami shnei umot, kigon bnei Yisrael lo knanim, shehem shnei umot, k'dechsi v'ayinu l'am echad," which implies that they were not originally one am echad, "l'ficha chutar lahem l'lchom, k'din uma sheba l'lchom al uma acheret, Shehitira Torah." Okay, so the Maral seems to take the position that individuals have no meaningful existence in the context of war. War is a contest among nations, and a contest among nations, you don't have to deal with the question of the guilt or innocence of individuals. And therefore, once Shimon and Levi go to war, all that matters is that they have, as a nation, they have received an affront from a criminal affront from another nation, and now they're reacting by punishing that nation. Individuals simply disappear. Right? He tells you this is what all wars are like. Afal gav hayu harbe shlo asu ein ze chiduk. Kevan shayu bi'o ta'uma. Since there were people in that nation, she'asav ra lahem, who did evil to them, mutarim levoy lahem elchama, you can go to war against them. Okay, so the Maral can be read as saying that there is no such, the concept of civilian or non-combatant is simply non-existent in Torah. The Torah conceives of all wars as total wars. Yes. What's your name?
Moshe.
Moshe. Thank you. What last name?
Levin.
Pardon?
Levin.
Okay. Very distinctive. Yes.
How does he go from one person, Shem himself, to saying even though there are only some people who did people against Israel, but it doesn't matter because it comes up with one person.
Yeah. So we could talk about what is the boundary between a, does it mean like that, does it mean that anytime any one person who belongs to one political group does something wrong to any one person belonging to any other political group, that justifies war? Or does it matter that Shechem is the political representative of that nation and we don't allow him to distinguish whether he's acting in his private capacity or his public capacity? Does it matter whether, right, the purpose of dinim is to determine whether that other political group, right, endorses the action or not? Does it have to be a national group in order to have war, right, or can be, right, or can I go to war against the Kiwanis Club? That's correct. He doesn't. Because this is not a very good legal analysis in some ways, right? It's Perish on Rashi. But, okay. I agree with you entirely. And one thing you have to get is that, you know, that the Maral generally lives in a world where abstraction, as a sort of Neoplatonic world. I wouldn't want to paskin that because Morel's philosophy is very difficult to decipher, whether it fits into existing categories or he's inventing his own terminology. But he lives in a world where abstractions are real. And so this makes more sense in his context than it might in an empirical 20th century universe where we think you can't, we're Aristotelians in that sense. Okay, that makes sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Yoni.
This is the Morel against the Rambam, right?
He's yes.
trying to explain the
Rambam. No, he's against the Rambam. He thinks the Rambam's, and it's important because later we can use the Morel as a precedent and say you can't use the Rambam. Because it's a really good kasha, but then he says something else, which appears to be at least as problematic if you're trying to find this. Yes.
How does he address the capturing of the woman and children to be separate from the killing of civilians? If there's no concept of civilians,
I don't know. I don't know at all. I really don't know at all. That's best I could. I just don't, I could speculate, but it wouldn't be fair. Okay, what I want to do here is I want to read the way that two contemporary poskim, Rav Herschel Schechter and Rav Asher Weiss, used this maral, beginning with a public confession that when I first was presented with Rav Schechter's use of this maral, I reacted very badly. And I thought, because I thought it really meant what when we first read the maral, we think it means, and I thought, wow, we really can't have people saying that halacha nowadays. And I wrote a fairly harsh response to the friend of mine who wrote an article which was based on Rav Schechter's article, because I said, how could you be doing this? And then so when it came up again earlier this year, I reacted badly again to the person who quoted it. And Rabbi Alex Ozer, who's a JLIC at Yale, pointed out correctly to me that I had misread, I had missed important things in Rav Schechter's piece, and that meant I had missed important things in my friend's piece many years before. So I was not there. Okay, let's take a look at what Rav Schechter says. We're on page. What page are we on? Still on page 4. Oh, there. Okay, my computer just unfroze. Okay, here's Rav Schechter says in Hebrew. Right, this is in Ikveh Hatzon Siman Lamed Beis. Well, Piyad Vrima Elo Haya Nir Elamar. The Bemet Kalvach said Hu Dinami. The Bemet Kalvach Chomer Bezmanaze. When the state of Israel is standing in a state of war, now that requires a whole set of a whole set of moves, as we noticed, right, to claim that at any point in time the state of Israel is in a permanent state of war, and for all military actions, the state of Israel are part of the war. Right, so Rav Schechter's move is that because there has not been peace, therefore every military action of the state of Israel is a continuation of the constant state of war declared in 1948. And that's how he gets everything to be a milchama, not only milchama, but milchamet mitzvah. Okay, sharei aravim toanim beferish v'pem alei, sheim rotsim Yerushalayim v'tel Aviv v'et Haifa. Okay, when he wrote, now Shoshana wrote this in the 80s probably, certainly before any peace treaties, before the Abraham Accords. So we could talk about, at what point halacha considers a state of war to cease with whom. Is it true that so long as any group is of the original group is still at war with you, that the war continues, or is there a point at which it ceases? With whom? To what extent? If you see the war currently is with Palestinians who don't have a state, right? There's all sorts of technical questions you can ask that way. But let's assume that this is all valid. Okay. Mehem. Sorry. Memele. Tzrichim anshei tzahal linhog im kol ha-mishtatfim be'ilah praot. And therefore, Tzahal, since he's engaged in Milchama Mitzvah, should react to terrorist attacks as if they are acts of war, and respond as if they are acts of war. And here's right. So watch. If there is a necessity for this, therefore, because of the state of war, if there is a necessity, you have to shoot to kill. And if there is a necessity, because sometimes you can't distinguish who are the terrorists who are organizing the terrorist raids and etc. Then Sahal is permitted and obligated to strike and even to kill. Kefi hadarush lenatzeach b'milchama, as is needed for victory. Even others of that nation who are in it, right, who are free of guilt. And then he quotes the Maharal. Right, so what I missed was three times. And quoting this Maharal, Rosh Hechter says, as necessary, then he creates an even higher standard, as necessary for victory, which might mean not just necessary for victory tactically, but necessary for victory strategically. In issues of proportionality, you have to deal with both levels, right? What is military necessity can be defined tactically, and military necessity can be defined strategically. Generally, international law functions on the tactical as opposed to the strategic. Rosh Hechter seems to have both sides. So it turns out, here's this Maharal, but Rosh Hechter does not understand the Maharal as meaning that individuals lose all their halachic significance. It means that when the act is necessary for the war, you can do that. Okay? However, one has to be very, very careful to, when you introduce even metaphors that have potentially dangerous implications, it's always possible that somebody, like, so I read it with outrage because I missed the qualifications. Somebody else might read it with joy at license. and miss the implications. So I want to show you what happened to the let's read the English version published Rosh Hechter's article. To be clear, Rosh Hechter does not, to my knowledge, in any way review the English translations of his articles. This has been an issue on a number of occasions. So let's watch the footnote. The Maharal of Prague, in his commentary Gur Aryeh to Parshas Vayishlach, writes, although the Torah reads, when you approach a city to wage war against it, you shall greet them peacefully, first attempt to reach a peaceful agreement, this speaks of a city that did not harm us. But as regards those who attacked the Jews, as Amalek did, anybody find any mention of Amalek in the Maharal? Nope. That just sort of crept in to the English translation. Why? Because somebody didn't want to see the distinctions. Because Amalek is a rhetorical trope for having no concern whatsoever for individual casualties. This is why I publicly, fight protests every single time people try to bring Amalek in, right, into discussions of contemporary events, because the reason to bring it in is because you wish to abandon all ethical constraint. And you can watch, right, how it just sneaks into this article. There's no place there at all. It's not there in the Hebrew. It's against the way Rosh Hechter read the Maharal. And yet there it is in the English. Okay, let's see how Rav Asher Weiss read a similar source. Okay, so in Divrei Hayamim, right now we're on the top of page 5. It says, "Vahi olai dvar Hashem lemor." Right, this is David Hamelech, after his thinking about building a Beit Hamikdash. So, "Vahi olai dvar Hashem lemor, dam larov shafachta u'melchamok dolot asita lo tivne bayit lishmi ki damim rabim shafachta arza lefanai." Okay, on this, the Radak says a number of astonishing things. The first thing, which is not central to the shir, but it's just a really cool thing. He says, "Vahi alai dvar Hashem lemor." Well, you actually know God never actually said that. Zelo matzano shamar lo Hashem. It doesn't say anywhere in Tanakh that God ever said this to David. Okay, so then he says, "Aval David amar kain b'libo, ki mipnei zemena ahu Hashem libnot habayit." But David had pangs of conscience. That's an amazing radak. He says the Vahi Alai Dvar Hashem Lemor is David's description of an attack of conscience about his own actions and doesn't actually mean that God spoke to him. Then he said, less interesting answer, you know what? And sometimes Tanakh only tells us that dialogue happened afterwards and doesn't present the dialogue live. Right, like, you know, sometimes we go through it, right, and then we have the problem, right? Why does the Torah tell us everything Eliezer said to Rivka, and then goes back and tells us everything that Eliezer says that he said to Rivka? Right? Sometimes we find the redundancy problem. Sometimes, right? And therefore, why should he have mentioned it? Okay. Now he goes and says, "Uvamro dam l'rov shafach ta'arza, ki dam nikiim hayu b'damim asher shafach, kimo dam Uria b'zelafanai." So some of the blood David shed was innocent. Now that one Uriah is the blood on his side that's innocent, even though he has a technical justification, as we saw. The gam de mea konim hayahu hasiba, kimosh amar hasiboti bechol nafshi beit avicha. David also is the indirect cause of Shaul wiping out the city of Nov ira kohanim, and perhaps he should have realized that when he asked the kohanim of Nov to provide him with aid when he was fleeing from Shaul, he should have realized it would have been retribution and retaliation. So David bears some accountability for that. And then the Radak says something much more radical. The gam d'mei ha-goyim asher shafach, otam shlo yu b'nei milchamto, efshar shayu b'hem anashim tovim v'chasidim. And it's also possible that in amongst the people of the other nations who David war against, there were people who were individually tovim v'chasidim. Afal pikein lo ne'enash aleihem. But even though David in those wars killed people who were individually righteous, he's not punished for them, and that brings up the question that Yonin pointed out earlier, right? Or Ben pointed out, right, about lo me'anshe. How do we read him not being punished for it? Ki kavanato lekalot rashim shleif ritzu b'Yisrael, because David's purpose was to wipe out the wicked, that they not attack Israel, even though he wiped out some of the tzadikim along with rishayim. Well, asmil asmo kishayar es plishtim lo yichaya ish v'isha. We're gonna have to leave that's a highly problematic verse on its own, but this is not quoted by anyone later. We're going to leave it out for now. Aval, kivan shenizdamein lo shvichut damim l'rov, mina'o milevnot beit ha-mikdash, shu l'shalom l'chaparat davon l'ateret tfila, kimo shemina'o l'hanif barzel b'mizbeach ha-beit ha-mikdash, l'fish ar barzel osim hema klei hariga, l'yosim hema klei shalom b'rov. All right, so David killed innocent people in the context of his war. He's not punished for that, because it's not illegal. However, he becomes invalid to build the Beit HaMikdash because it turns him into a tool of war. And just like metal objects cannot be used to build the Beit HaMikdash, so too warriors cannot be used to build the Beit HaMikdash. Yes, you had a question. Well, that's exactly what I'm asking, right? What is Radak? Right? What is Radak saying? We're reading Radak is saying, okay, so everything is great. Just war has consequences for you, which are not a function of having done things wrong. Mm-hmm. All right, that I think essentially is the way the Rambam read the episode in Tanakh. Right, the Rambam is obviously not reading the Radak. They read it as that there's either that the David's ability to engage in war reflected a coarseness in his character, having engaged in war coarsened David's character. You can find both of these in Chazal. Right, you have the idea that there were as many Arei Miklat in Eivra Yarden as there were on this side, because the people, the Reuven Gad and Chassi Shevet Menashe, were in the vanguard of the war, and so there's just going to be less inhibition about violence in a community built of frontline soldiers. Right, and brachos that we give people, right? Or, you know, and then you can talk about that's true or not, right? Historic, right? You know, you have your own experience. And it's hard to know because, you know, we don't really have cultures built of frontline soldiers specifically. Okay, so which way do we read it? So here's how Rav Asher Weiss reads it. V'lamadnu af mitvarav. D'me'ikir hadin, ein lihimona meherigat terotzkim af im chafim mipesha neragim v'hem. So we can learn that Ikar Adin, in whatever context he's thinking about, you shouldn't stop killing the murderers just because there is collateral damage. Right, because of this, David was not punished for the much blood he shed. So right, it sounds like, right, you know, like there, it's something that was done was wrong, right? It's a pegam misuyam shel shvichut damin. Right, so Asher Weiss reads it, I think, and that's how he comes out lahalacha. He says the gam idvarav yesh lavin gefishin is ba'er le'el the bevadai yesh lishtadel b'mniat harigatam shel elish lo pashuv lochatu, right? That you have to make every effort to avoid civilian casualties. And right, and maybe even David, right, because it's hard to hold people to account, because as we know, right, and maybe we can, but when there are going to be civilian casualties in war, so David couldn't be punished for it. But you can, right? But David's not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash because he was insufficiently careful about civilian casualties. Right? So that's how that's how Rav Asher Weiss read the Radak, which I'm not sure. Well, actually, I'm pretty sure is not shot in the Radak at all, but for a different reason. Rav Asher Weiss is reading Sheinam b'nei milchamto as civilians, and I think that if you looked at other places in Radak, you'll see Sheinam b'nei milchamto means people who belong to a nation that has no direct battle with you. Right, it's allies, and that's why when Shaul tells the Keni to leave Misar mitocha Amaliki, it's not because he's trying to avoid civilian casualties. It's because they're there as armed, right? As armed allies, and he's telling them, "I have no quarrel with you, right? You should just leave." And that's also law b'nei milchamto. But be that as it may, Rav Asher Weiss reads this as an imperative to avoid civilian casualties. Rav Asher Weiss gets this, I think, from Rav Avadi Yosef in a famous tshuva to Kohanim, where a Kohen who is a veteran of the 1967 war asks whether, right, because I killed soldiers of the invading Arab armies, right, am I therefore a shofech damim in such a way that prevents me from being nosei kapai? And Rav Avadia answers that no, it doesn't. In the context of answering that, no, it doesn't, Rav Avadia said that says the following. He says, look, there's this Radak. And the Radak says that David is prevented from building the Beit HaMikdash only because he was insufficiently careful about civilian casualties. That implies, says Rav Avadia, that for killing the soldiers of the opposing army, there's nothing wrong at all. And therefore, and since he says Nesiat Kapayim is parallel to Binyan Beit HaMikdash, they're both things that are fundamentally about Shalom. So since David would have been allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash if he had only killed enemy soldiers, therefore you can do Birkat Kohanim because you only killed enemy soldiers. And killing enemy soldiers is a mitzvah. Doesn't tell you what he would say. Of somebody, right, what he would say if a soldier came to him and asked the question, I killed enemy civilians, am I allowed to do Nesiat Kapayim? There is a version of that question that is asked to Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein in Chashuke Chemed, which is on page 6. We're not going to have time to read it inside. One should be careful about Chashuke Chemed. I have a highly idiosyncratic and controversial position about Chashuke Chemed. It's presented as being halachic tshuvot. But in the introduction, it tells you that it's not supposed to be read that way. It's actually just a series of exercises showing you how Gemara Sugyo could be applied to contemporary circumstances. And so my own position is that one should never, ever, ever quite quote Chashuke Chemed as Halacha Lamasa, because it rarely gets to the question of whether we should paskin this way. It just creates halachic arguments. And that, you know, when reading Tshuvot, that often you read the Tshuva and it goes through all the arguments, and the end of it says, but you shouldn't do this for a totally different reason. Right, so Chashuke Chemed should not be read l'halacha. Right, it's the exposition of the theoretical application of certain sugyot to situations, and because it's organized by the daf, it's a great resource for daf yomi shurim. But it's really, really bad things would happen if you paskin like it l'masa many, many times, like not bringing your children into sealed rooms when they're asleep and an alarm goes off. Just to give the one particular tshuva that really got me. But in this case, hold on. In this case, he raises an issue which I think that the same is true, but it makes a point. The question he asks is, also, I think that even though they're presented as questions to Lamasa issues, if you read the introduction, I think he's making up the questions from real life, you know, in sort of the way I do in the summer. So he comes to the question, what if, put the name, he doesn't use a name, what if someone who, act, you know, like someone in the circumstance of Elor Azariah, right, somebody raises, he presents it somewhat more dramatically, I shot a terrorist, but I'm not sure they might have raised their hands and surrendered before I shot them. Have I done anything wrong? And his answer is, well, I don't think you'd be allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash. Right, that's playing out Rav Ravadia. Rav Ravadia says that because you only killed enemy soldiers, right? The whole point is Radak says that David is only held liable because Dam Larov Shefachta, which means that you killed some people you shouldn't have killed. But in your case, because you were fighting against in a pitched battle against invading Arab armies, there's no such concern. Now I think Lamasa, that's why Lamasa, you know, it's a notion that soldiers who acted in good faith, but ended up killing civilians should be prevented from building the Beit HaMikdash, let alone the Siyak Kapayim, that's probably the wrong psak. But the theoretical structure about what you ought to be aspiring to, I think that the Chashuk HaChemed plays out the implications of the Rav Avad Yosef correctly. Okay, so we have, right, so that's, we have Rav Schachter and Rav Asher Weiss, and what you have is, I think, a clear indication that when people read sources that seem to be saying that there is license to, right, for war to be in an unethical zone, they resist, which is what I'm modeling in my reading of the earlier sources. Right, that just can't be. Why can't it be? Because it's a violation of Lichtenstein's dictum that we have, right, that we haven't left the world, right, haven't left the world of a world of one values to a world of other values. Okay, now the most comprehensive attempt that I know of to address the question of civilian casualties is an article by Rav Shaul Yisraeli called the Raid at Kiviyah, Maaseh Kiviyah al Pi Halacha. Those of you who are interested in doing this in great depth later, there is a journal called thelairhouse.com, which happens to have a managing editor named Davida Kolmar, who is, I think, along with Rabbi Zering, the other four-time... There you go. Okay, right. Four time Summer Bit Midrash alum. One year as a, she did several years as administrator, and it happens my article was edited by Rabbi David Fried, who was another alum. So it was a wonderful experience putting it together, and that's an attempt to try and do it more comprehensively. But if that doesn't satisfy you, if you've already signed up for Navar Torah, and if you get on the list by the end of this week, you'll get the even longer version of the article that was cut down by Lairhouse for publication because they thought it had many distractions. We're not going to have time to do the whole Rosh Hashanah Israeli thing now. So we'll try it, but I want to try and set out its structure to you, and then I want to set out the last part of it, which is perhaps the most risky. So the issue Israeli is dealing with is that in 1953, now I'm going to give the facts the way he has them. You can go look at Wikipedia, whatever source you want afterwards, and try and figure out what actually happened, right? Because obviously there's a great deal of controversy about that. But what seems to have happened, it is certainly Israeli's mind is that there are Arab villages, right? This is 1953. So we're not talking, right? There are no occupied territories, right? There's just Arab villages in Jordan from which there are terrorists coming across and attacking within the boundaries of the state of Israel. I think they were called Fedayin then. One of those attacks was led to the death of a mother and her child. And there was a reprisal raid against the Arab village from which it was believed the terrorists came. And Rav Israeli was under the impression, which I cannot endorse or not endorse, that it was well known that terrorists came from and were supported by the villagers of that Arab village known as Kiviyah. The reprisal raid, which was Israeli doesn't mention this, was led by Colonel Ariel Sharon, blew up a number of houses in that village, having failed to completely evacuate them previously. So any number of women and children were killed in that raid. It caused a whole international outrage. Later that year, Rosh Israeli publishes an article about whether the raid was justified al pi halacha. It begins with the statement that obviously everyone is hypocritical and uses double standards, and criticizes Israel for things that they don't hold anybody else accountable for. But he says, we can criticize them all we want, but that doesn't excuse us from asking the question whether this is or is not okay Jewishly. We have to obey our own standards, whether or not we think they are being fair, other people are being fair and holding us to our standards. So he asked the question, can you or can you not justify this reprisal raid, which led to the deaths of women and children who are presumed babies, who are presumptive non-combatants, obviously, in that context. So he starts off, which is a really interesting structure. He starts off by not asking the question about war at all. He asks the question, right? The question he asks is it possible to justify the action simply in the realm of criminal justice? Okay, which is a version of trying to use the Rambam about Shechem as opposed to the Maharal. And he comes, right, he comes up with a whole set of possibilities and rejects them all. And he says that, you know, you could try and claim that they're incidental rodfim, because they prevent you from defending yourself accurately. You could try and claim that they're accessories to rodfim. At the end of the day, he says none of those answers, no civilian answer could possibly justify the unnecessary killing of infants. And most of them can't even justify the killing of infants if it accomplishes a military purpose that could not be accomplished the other way. Right? And at the end of the day, he says that the prohibition against targeting the best argument is that the presence of infants prevents you from attacking the terrorists, and therefore, you could argue that the infants are also rodfim because they are preventing you from preventing the murders. And he rejects this. He says you can't say that about infants. Now, infants cannot be killed as accidental rodfim. They have no accountability that way. They're not making any choices at all. Not even making choices under duress. They're not making choices at all. And so if the article had ended, ended at that point, I would have been a very cheerful person. But I should say that it is, you know, it is one of the most amazing intellectual pieces of halacha I have ever read. You come out absolutely just amazed at the depth of his thought and scholarship. And the really interesting moral implications. There are some things in that article which are eternally, you know, which... he ends up justifying war in a way that I don't know that anybody previously had, by saying that he believes fundamentally in human autonomy. The article was written to some degree in response to a famous Rav Zevin piece called Mishpat Shylock, which Rav Zevin argued that human beings don't own themselves. And probably you've read it all. You know, Judaism believes that your body belongs to God, not to you. And sort of Rav Yisraeli writes against that. Nope. Actually, human beings own their own bodies, except maybe for Jews. Right? Jews, God owns part of their bodies, and therefore Jews have less autonomy than non-Jews in this way. Jews only have autonomy if God gives up his share in their bodies. But therefore, he argues that non-Jews have non-Jews are entitled to go to war because as long as they agree on the rules of the game in advance, and then you're autonomously risking your life. And Jews can go to war in a situation where God allows them to. And if God allows them to, so then they're also agreeing to play by the rules of war. And the outcome is that killing in war is only permissible if you are playing according to the universally agreed rules of war. Because the only permission to kill in war is the autonomous surrender of the people involved of their right to life. And therefore, if you live in a world of the Geneva Convention where there is no right to kill civilians, there is no right to kill civilians. So if the article, gotta hold off, I'll stay afterwards to take questions, but we only have 4 minutes left. So if the article ended there, that would be, there are all sorts of technical questions you're thinking about, like, how do we know whether it's universally agreed? What about somebody who doesn't agree with those? Are all those sorts of questions which have to be addressed practically. But that's his fundamental theory. That killing in war is only permitted according to the rules of war. Killing, right, people who don't follow the rules of war are criminals. And you're right, it's a different system. Okay, and what constitutes the rule of war? If there's right, it's probably determined, people say, by practice as opposed to by theory. But whose practice, right? All sorts of things, right? Gets back to the question of who's allowed to engage in war. But then at the very end, he just totally reverses himself. And he invents a new kind of Milchemet Mitzvah. And the new kind of Milchemet Mitzvah he invents is Milchemet Midyan. And he says Milchemet Midyan is a war of revenge. And a war of revenge is not subject to any of the ethical limitations of other wars. That's a pretty astounding, right? And that's the only way he can justify he can justify kiviyah. And then he says that even that would never justify targeting innocence. It only allows you to accept collateral damage, which otherwise he thinks is not acceptable at all. Right? You can't collateral damage innocence is not acceptable at all. I think that it's an incredible article, but I don't think it's correct. I don't think it's possible to say that Milchemet Midyan models a new kind of Milchemet Mitzvah, which is not present in any earlier sources. Attempt to read the Rambam is unconvincing. I put on the Makor the Ramban, who says explicitly that Milchemet Midyan is a Milchemet Rishut. And I realized just before I published the article and pulled the article back and finished it that Rabbi Israeli himself, in an article 6 years later, rejects this entirely. Implicitly, without saying so, but like he goes through his whole analysis of Milchemet Midyan and never mentions this at all. So just be aware, right? There is such a theory. People will sometimes quote Rav Yisraeli as saying that. I think that the great significance of Rav Yisraeli's article is his rejection of every other possible argument, even for incidental casualties, except when for direct military necessity. And the addition of Milchemet Midyan was there as a limit schut for the raid on Kiviyah, which he himself, the Lumdus himself does not follow through some years later. So that's the shorthand presentation of this material. Again, you can look at the article on Rav Yisraeli for the full presentation specifically of Rav Yisraeli's arguments. I think the end of it tells you that to claim that there is a consensus in Jewish tradition would be plainly dishonest. To claim that there is a strong, at least defensible and possibly compelling position, both in classical sources and in contemporary sources, that argues that civilian casual that you one has to be careful that the only heter for civilian casualties is military necessity, however defined, maybe to the highest standard of necessity for victory, strategic necessity, and not just tactical necessity. And that there's, and that we judge people, even when we can't hold people legally accountable, because it's really hard to hold legally accountable in the fog of war, we have a very high ethical, separate ethical standard, which has a theoretical nafkamina in terms of building a Beit HaMikdash, and possibly a concrete nafkamina nowadays in terms of Birkat Kohanim, although I understand why, and I tend to support the notion that it would be very unwise to actually apply that nafkamina except in the most extreme cases. All right, thank you. If you found the shiur worthwhile and you think that this kind of learning is worthwhile, then you are encouraged to come learn with me. Certainly, please sign up for the Dvar Torah list. I'll take a few questions publicly, and then you probably have to go to lunch. So, but you're welcome to come up and talk to me afterwards or email me, as it may be. Okay, yes. Yeah.
Not a rabbi because he doesn't have any choice in the matter.
Yeah.
Isn't there a whole concept of an unborn baby, for example?
Yes, exactly right. So an unborn so that's exactly what Israeli says. An unborn baby can be a rodev, but in the exact same circumstances, a born baby cannot be.
Why?
So his argument is because an unborn baby is not yet a full person.
I mean, he also doesn't have a choice.
That's right, but he's not a person. So you can just, right? So he analogizes it, and again, this is much more complicated, but he analogizes it to the Rambam's case of luggage. Rambam says you can throw somebody else's luggage overboard as a rodev. Because it's luggage. Now, obviously, a fetus is much more valuable than a luggage, but it's not the same. It's not yet a nefesh. But a nefesh, he says, cannot be killed as a rodev unless there's volition involved. Right? That's exactly the argument he makes. Thank you. Okay, so you had a question, Sean?
Yes. Given that... as far as I understand, the Geneva Convention has literally never been followed in any war, but it never occurred.
Yeah.
How can we consider it?
So again, Rav Yisraeli is taken generally as the source that international law generally is binding, but you have this, you have the question like, what does it mean for law? What about laws that are only aspirational? What about laws that? Right, that are on the books, but no one actually expects to be enforced. What about laws that were, that were accepted by force? Modar Rabbe Loraisa. All those sorts of questions are fair. Israel signed the Geneva Accords, right? So that might be that what you volitionally sign and bind yourself to is different. But I'm not posking that question. I'm just telling you this is how Rabbi Israeli sets it out, and then you could ask that question lamasa. There's another way of doing it, which is in terms of through the Shavuot to the Givonim, that makes self-imposed obligations binding. I would say that it's also, the first level answer is, it's also true there's never been a society in which there isn't theft. But there are laws against theft. And pretty much the world understands, right, that there are laws against theft. And, there's a consciousness of guilt. And the truth is, when armies go to war against each other in the contemporary world, it's very different than it was in the world before the Geneva Convention. I think that's certainly true, right? Even, we don't go to, but you're right that international law has no binding mechanism. So the notion, right, in which this law is a challenging issue, right? Many of the claims that someone violated international law are just based on private interpretation or misunderstandings, like proportionality is always misused. So it's not really clear, true that no war is ever fought that way. It's just that there are often extreme interpretations that the war, right, that it's not fought that way. So I think it's more complicated. The question is right, as I acknowledge, but I don't think the answer is that this is meaningless. We have court trials, right, of particular people who are as war criminals, right. So there is some notion of standard. The U.S. certainly holds itself to those standards to a certain degree. I don't think it's quite as extreme as you're saying. The issue of asymmetric warfare obviously is a very big issue, but maybe it's not war when there's no other nation on the other side. That's right. That's the flip side. Is maybe the whole model of war halakhically doesn't apply to it, right? Unless you recognize the other side as a state. Okay. Yes.
Would you say that the case where we by accidentally killed the hostages?
Obviously, as with the other thing, right, this is such a sensitive question, and the psychological damage to the people seems so severe that I wouldn't want to answer it lamaase. But generally, right, we have a category of people of killing people accidentally, and then we have a category of killing people beonis, and then there are categories in the middle called things like that. And you have to figure out, to what degree was it plausible for people to think otherwise, right? That's the only way you can answer, right? Underlying it, right, is you took a life. But there are circumstances in which we hold you excusable, and there are circumstances where we hold you sort of excusable, right? That's why you have your miklat. And there are situations where we hold you not right. We say you're not good enough, too bad for an Iri Miklat, but not serious enough to impose worse crimes. I think that's right. There are things which aren't even shogeg. I don't know the circumstances well enough to talk about individual people who are. It would be irresponsible to paskin that way. I think that would be the answer. But I think there's no reason to assume it doesn't fall somewhere along that spectrum. I've never been in battle, so it's hard for me to judge that.
Call it officially now. Thank you very much, Roy Clapper. As Roy Clapper said, he'll stick